Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
A man who became badly ill while working near the Auckland Harbour Bridge is speaking out after revelations the land was contaminated with heavy metals. Ralph Morgan says his employer, Auckland Council, should have taken more precautions because it knew about the problem but didn't tell him. RNZ recently revealed the council knew since 2011 about the elevated heavy metal levels in soil at both ends of the Harbour Bridge. But the council argues the health risks were low and it's taken all reasonable steps to respond to Mr. Morgan's concerns. Mr. Morgan worked without protection, shovelling up dust for a day in an unidentified hotspot near West Haven Marina in March 2014. The council says subsequent tests showed elevated levels of zinc, lead, chromium and nickel, but not at levels of a risk to human health. ACC accepted Mr. Morgan's claim for acute pneumonitis, but rejected his claim of heavy metal poisoning. A 59-year-old and his wife Jane, a nurse, are in no doubt bridge maintenance dust has made him sick.
Yeah, I was working underneath the harbour bridge where we've got a compound and I was emptying it out. It had never been cleaned for 18 years. There was a lot of dust which I swept up. I ingested it and I became very ill. And
did you wear a mask?
No, there was no mask. There was no health and safety. There was no checks done there. Nobody seemed to be aware that there was any problem. On the way home, I just felt ill. For the two-hour drive home, my nose just continually run. I became incontinent in bed several times. Was pretty ill. Couldn't do nothing. Tried to go back to my work.
It culminates with you having to have heart surgery, is that right?
Yeah. I had quadruple open heart surgery. Half my heart had actually died, I was told. I had been at the doctor 33 occasions over 18 months, severely ill, and I kept getting told that there was nothing wrong with me.
I've watched Ralph decline from the day he came home that day. He had died twice with me. All the heavy metals that Ralph had been exposed to, he had every single symptom that you can find in a textbook.
Did they say that was because of the heavy metals, or did they not offer a reason?
Yeah, they told my wife that I had heavy metal poisoning. I've been desperately trying to get some help, and I just keep coming up against brick walls.
Did you get any advice, precautions? Because I know you didn't have any PPE, but did they advise you to take care with the dust you were shoveling up?
If they were assessed to me it was dangerous, I would have made sure that I'd done it in a safe manner. Auckland City Council denied it. They ever knew anything existed there.
So when you saw the RNZ report about the bridge contamination on the north side, you're saying that's the first time that you knew that the Auckland Council had known that there was dust and that it had heavy metals in it?
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's why they contacted you.
My thing is that all I want is for everybody to be able to go to their work and return back home safe at night. And if there is a problem somewhere, that we solve it.
Today, Cabinet is poised to sign off on making masks mandatory on all public transport in Auckland and all domestic flights around the country. Pleas to wear masks have gone largely unheeded. But after the community transmission scare last week, more Aucklanders are coming on board. Katie Todd has been talking to commuters at the city's public transport hub, Britomart, about how prepared they are to mask up.
Aucklanders got used to wearing masks on planes and public transport when they became compulsory during the Level 3 lockdown in August. The call went out again last week to wear masks on public transport with the emergence of the Defence Force cluster. Today, the COVID-19 Response Minister Chris Hipkins will go to Cabinet with a new order to make masks mandatory for Auckland bus, ferry and train passengers. It's something epidemiologists have been calling for months, and it gets a clear yes vote from these commuters, who say even since Friday, when all central city workers were urged to work from home, up to 50% of their fellow passengers haven't been wearing masks.
It makes total sense, and it's a small price to pay, so we don't have to go into any of these lockdowns anymore. I'm totally 100% behind it.
This will stop spreading the coronavirus, so yeah.
I mean, it's not a big deal to wear a mask. It's not really intrusive or anything. I think people would just be a bit pig-headed.
I financially can't afford to have another lockdown again, so just harden up and put on a mask.
Chris Hipkins says similar measures could be on the way for the rest of the country, particularly places with managed isolation facilities. Mandy Kirk says she can understand why the need is more urgent in Auckland, but she hopes school buses won't be exempt this time.
School buses as well. Even when we had to wear masks on public transport, school buses were packed full of 30-plus children and not a single mask.
Today, Cabinet will also consider making masks mandatory on domestic flights right across the country. Commuters David and Tracy Blackford think that's logical.
It's no big deal. New Zealand's small enough, you're only in a plane for a maximum of an hour and a half or something, so what's the big deal, right?
My son came up from Christchurch and I rang and made sure that he had a mask. He said he was probably one of the only people that had them on, but yeah, we'll definitely advocate using them.
Enforcement proved a sticking point the last time masks were mandatory. Then unions agreed with operators like Auckland Transport that it was impossible for bus and train drivers to police the rule. Cabinet will also have to look at what kind of penalties people could face if they don't wear a mask. Simon Adams doesn't want passengers being slapped with steep fines straight away.
It's quite a big change for a lot of people's daily lives. I don't know if penalties should really be that harsh at all.
In the near future, Cabinet will also be looking at making scanning QR codes or some other form of contact tracing mandatory. That doesn't sit so comfortably with this commuter, Harry.
Does make sense if there's a scare, but I don't think it's fair to ask everyone to track everywhere they've gone for the next year.
If Cabinet agrees on the new mask order, it will also announce a start date, which could be as soon as Thursday. Full Morning Report, call Katie Todd, TNA.
Written off, having not played a test in over a year, Argentina inflicted a historic defeat on the All Blacks in Sydney at the weekend. The Pumas triumphing 25-15 in a match they, well, pretty much dominated throughout. It was the first time the Pumas had beaten the All Blacks in 30 attempts. And get this, 35 years. It's also the first time in 9 years the All Blacks have suffered consecutive test losses, having lost to Australia the previous weekend in Sydney. Sports editor Stephen Houston has more.
A boil over felt in Buenos Aires. Los Pumas, muy bueno. They win against the All Blacks.
Out-muscled, out-hustled and out-thought. Argentina didn't just sneak victory, they outplay the All Blacks, and all on the back of no test rugby since the World Cup in Japan last year. The Argentinians have also been hit hard by COVID-19, with several players having been struck down by the virus and having to go through strict quarantine in Australia. Coach Mario Ledesma, who played 84 tests for his country, shed tears of joy after the win and says the victory will go down in rugby folklore.
I think we remember this for a long time coming, not only because of the game, but this special situation that got us to the game. I guess somebody will write a book about it.
The Pumas replicated the game plan England used in their World Cup semi-final win over the All Blacks last year. It was based on intensity at the breakdown, bone-crushing first-up tackles and suffocating defence. And just as in Japan, the All Blacks were unable to come up with a plan B, which coach Ian Foster admits is a concern.
We do need a bit more variety. And I think you go to Eden Park, Sydney, it was the changes and the pitches that we saw and the variety that we were willing to use that actually created the opportunity. And, you know, I think we're getting used to a few new systems and there is a feel that we're just getting a little bit too programmed in some aspects and we need to tweak that. There's no doubt about that.
The All Blacks captain, Sam Kane, admits they also failed to learn from the previous weekend's loss to the Wallabies when the Australians managed to niggle away at them. Former All Blacks coach Laurie Mayne says the Pumas seem to take a leaf out of former All Black captain Sean Fitzpatrick's playbook.
Just about swear Sean Fitzpatrick was coaching that side. They did get under the skin of their opposition, the Argentinians, but there was some silly stuff there that there's just no need for. And there are one or two players in the All Blacks that are inclined to respond to that.
With just two wins from his first five tests in charge, the pressure's now on coach Ian Foster. When he was appointed as Steve Hansen's replacement, critics suggested Foster hadn't achieved enough success with the likes of the Chiefs to warrant the job. But his own future is not something Foster says he's thinking about.
What I feel right now is massive disappointment, but we haven't achieved what we wanted to achieve in the last two games. And so, you know, the key right now is for me is, you know, we've got a lot of good people in this group. We've shown we can perform at a high level. We've just got to go back to do it. And the word pressure's there all the time.
Former All Blacks coach Laurie Main says it's too early to make judgments on Foster.
That coaching team, they're not silly, and they will have witnessed what happens, and they'll realise they've got to have a plan B up their sleeve when teams are putting them under great pressure.
Ian Foster and his All Blacks side now have 2 weeks to stew on the result and come up with a plan B for when they play Argentina again in Newcastle in what will be their final test of the year. After that, they'll head home for 2 weeks of quarantine. Lose a third straight test, and 2 weeks in isolation might all of a sudden sound very appealing. For Morning Report, Stephen Hewson.
1,000 early childhood teachers have so little confidence in the learning centres, the early learning centres they work in, that they wouldn't send their own children there. The teachers were among 4,000 who responded to a survey by the organisation Child Forum. They reported problems including too much noise, too many children, and too much focus on profit. John Gerritsen is our education correspondent and joins us now. John.
Good morning.
Good morning. So bad that they wouldn't send their own children.
Yeah, that's right. The question was, would you send your own children to this centre that you work in or one like it? And a quarter of the respondents said no, they wouldn't. Now, comments in the survey indicate the sort of main thing that's going on there is a concern about too many children in a small space with maybe not quite enough teachers. So teachers were talking about crowding, about not having enough time to concentrate on the individual needs of the children around them. Look, one of them was calling it crowd control. Another said their centre was like a prison. And another said, look, I had to concentrate so much on the children who are biting and hitting that the quiet ones are missing out. 11% of the respondents, of the 4,000 respondents, said their centre usually runs out of ratio. And what that means is they have fewer teachers working with the children than the legal minimum. And the way this is done is by writing on the paper returns showing how many teachers there are and including someone who's maybe working in an office at the time. So that's the sort of thing that they are complaining about, yeah.
Pretty serious stuff.
Yeah, it's certainly worrying. I mean, I must say, this isn't a representative survey. It's not a random sample, but people were invited to respond. And, of course, the majority, three-quarters of the respondents said they were, you know, they were happy with the centre they were at. But still, 1,000 teachers saying they're unhappy is pretty significant. And it comes as complaints to the Education Ministry have been going up over the years. So, yeah, definitely something to take seriously. And especially when you think about early childhood involving very young children and really critical stage in children's development.
So what's going on here? Is it resourcing? Is it just areas that are stretched? What do you think?
Well, certainly from talking to teachers over the years and looking at reports like this, it seems that some centres are really feeling the pinch. Teachers have said to me often that they feel the people who own the centre they work in are too focused on in profit. But I must add, I do know people who own centres who are not taking any profit, in fact, not even paying themselves, so that they can get through rough times because with COVID and so forth at the moment, there is often a shortage of children and some centres are finding it hard to make ends meet.
How do you think this will go down then in government?
Well, the message to government from Child Forum is you're listening a lot to organisations that represent centre owners. You need to start listening to teachers, because one of the things that's coming through is teachers are seeing problems that are not being reported in the official record. Someone needs to be talking to them to find out, well, you know, what effect are your policies happening? How is this playing out? And I know from personal experience, talking to teachers anonymously, they're too scared to complain sometimes. They really feel there'll be a backlash, that it'll be too easy to identify that they're the one making the complaint. And so there are some barriers there to getting the full picture.
Mm. Now, it is also, what, the first day of NCEA exams?
It certainly is. 140,000 teenagers getting themselves ready.
I've got one.
Yeah, yes, I've got one as well.
One in exams.
Yeah, exactly. So, look, the exams are starting. Interesting fact this year is quite a lot of them are going to be online. About 35,000 students out of the 140,000 will be doing at least some of their exams online. But, look, the big thing looming over all of this year is the impact of COVID. No one's quite sure how that's going to play out. I've talked to teachers who've said, kids are fine, my students are doing well. I've talked to others who said, really worried, some of these young people haven't had enough time to prepare and they're stressed out. So it's a very,
yeah,
very varied
impact. And the other thing
is,
what happens if there is a lockdown in the middle of it?
Yeah, the NZQA has said, look, at level 3, we will still have the exams. So that's clear. No mention of level four, but yeah. Certainly levels 1, 2,
but
and 3.
But that adds to the stress. I mean, it does. You know, if you've got that hanging over you.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what's worrying some principals, is that teenagers are going to be thinking about these what-ifs and so forth, and then also the stress in their own communities and in their own families, and that's going to affect their performance. We don't know until it all happens. Who knows?
John Gerritsen, our education correspondent, thank you very much for that. Returning to our top story on the new trade agreement, 8 years of negotiations has culminated in the government signing what is the world's largest free trade agreement by population and GDP. New Zealand is one of 15 Asia-Pacific countries to join the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership trade deal, better known as RCEP. Now, some critics say the deal was unnecessary and offers little beyond the status quo, while others applaud the certainty it will provide for exporters. Former senior government trade deal negotiator Charles Finney is in our Wellington studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Corin.
Okay. The framework that this provides, the stability, the certainty that the minister was talking about this morning, that is good. Most commentators would agree there's a pretty good consensus that that's to be welcomed.
Oh, absolutely. Obviously, I'm one of the people that would like to have had India in the deal, but even without India there, this is going to provide a common set of rules, a dispute settlement mechanism that will be very positive for such a large part of the global economy. We've been worried about having so many small agreements with their own unique rules of origin. This helps simplify the noodle bowl, and it's going to add certainty for New Zealand exporters, so it's a good thing.
Yeah, and in a time of global economic uncertainty, as a small country that relies on rules, that's all good. But in terms of this being promoted as something that earns New Zealand $2 billion a year in actual financial gains, I mean, where do the tariffs come from in this? Because we've already got them with all those countries, haven't we?
Yeah, we already have free trade agreements with all the parties to the agreement. There does seem to be some advantage in the Indonesia market for goods exporters, and in terms of services exporters, some new concessions from Thailand. So that's all very, very positive. But anything that is going to encourage growth in this vital region for us will have economic benefits to New Zealand. So I think that's where the $2 billion figure is probably coming from, as opposed to tariff advantage. Don't forget, this is the first free trade agreement involving China, Korea and Japan. That's a very positive thing, and it will lead to some growth in the region.
Is this China setting the new trade rules for a new era?
There are a number of commentators, particularly out of the United States and Europe, who have seen this as a Chinese-led initiative. Actually, this is an ASEAN-led initiative. It used to be known as ASEAN Plus 6. China has obviously been a key player at the table. The rules of origin will make it more difficult for those in the United States and elsewhere who are trying to decouple from China. That's absolutely true. But this is an agreement that was not essentially China's idea. It is an ASEAN-led agreement.
Will that reduce the ability for the potential for these non-tariff trade barriers to crop up? And I'm looking at Australia at the moment, in fact, where we're seeing a number of products in Australia, wine, barley, there's others, that the Chinese government is telling their importers not to import. And this seems to be linked to geopolitical issues around Australia perhaps pushing back a bit harder on other issues. Is this deal going to, what's this deal going to do for that sort of thing?
Well, for a start, this deal has got to be ratified. It hasn't come into force yet. It's only been signed. So every jurisdiction will be putting it through their own ratification processes. So it means nothing in the short term in terms of what you're talking about. But WTO rules, and don't forget, Australia has a free trade agreement with China. So there are already mechanisms there for Australia to address those problems. China seems to have an excuse for each of these measures that have been implemented. Some are still a little bit uncertain, something we should be watching very closely. Unfortunately, some of the major players right now aren't necessarily abiding by international trade rules. The United States is probably the most guilty party there, and unfortunately the WTO dispute settlement mechanism isn't functioning properly.
So how vulnerable is New Zealand? Because if we go into this RCEP deal It is, okay, debatable whether it's China-led, but certainly they are a key player. Our ability to criticise China without there being trade repercussions?
Look, my view is that we are in an equal relationship with China. We want to be good friends with China. On most issues, we will agree, but there will be occasional disagreements. And in terms of a mature relationship, we should be free to express our mind. I don't see anything that New Zealand has said in recent times as risking any form of retaliation from China. But China should not be retaliating for political differences in the trade arena. That's not on.
Separately to that, or perhaps not, but let's say it's separate for now. There is this issue with COVID-19. The Chinese have said they've found imported beef with frozen beef with COVID-19 on it. They've tested New Zealand's products, been caught up with that in the warehouse. We don't look like we're directly at issue of having exported it, but nonetheless, that will be raising concerns for our exporters, I would have thought.
Yeah, obviously it's very strange. It's most likely any contamination did not occur in New Zealand. It's occurred elsewhere. I doubt this will impact on our trade, but it's something we should be watching very closely.
Charles Finney, thank you very much for your time. A family at the heart of the country's biggest COVID cluster has described the fear and shock of coming face-to-face with the virus. Auckland's August outbreak infected 179 people, sending the city back to level 3 and the rest of the country to level 2. In a first for the country, most of those who caught the virus and often their families went into full quarantine at the Jet Park Hotel. Few people from the cluster have spoken publicly, but one family who had 5 members catch the virus has told our health correspondent Rowan Quinn about their experience.
Once my grandchildren tested positive, that's where I was very frightened. I was scared because when I think of what the media was saying, and I think it's going to be worse.
This Auckland grandmother lives with her husband, her daughter and her 5 grandchildren, a tight-knit family used to doing everything together. It was her 2 teenage grandchildren who were first to get the virus that would eventually infect 5 of them. They'd gone to get tested as a family after finding out they were close contacts of a positive case. Her daughter says initially they tested negative.
The following week, the kids started showing normal flu-type signs, but we wanted to be extra precautious, so we took them and we got them tested again at our local GP, and luckily for that, that's where we realised that they had tested positive.
Suddenly they were told the 2 children had to go to the Jet Park and their grandmother was going too to look after them.
From then, I guess you could say, chaos hit us because this was the first time, and you know, we were so in shock and didn't know what to make of it, and had to listen to everything from Ministry of Health, who were calling through just to give us advice.
Shortly after the 2 teens tested positive, their 74-year-old grandfather did too. He was next to move to the Jet Park, followed by his daughter, who had to go into quarantine to look after the 2 other children who'd by now caught the virus. Then things became very frightening. Their grandfather became so sick he was rushed to hospital twice, something he had to go through alone.
To be honest, I was very, very sad, and I was a little bit angry too. So, yes, and all we can do is just pray and wait for what's the story from North Shore Hospital.
He's now doing well, but is still taking it a little easy. Ofira Taulealea Usumai is a whānau ora navigator with the Whānau, an Auckland clinic that provides health and social services from a Pacific point of view. She provided wraparound support to about 40 families connected with the cluster. She says many were in a state of shock and they had very little time to move.
We were ringing them and they would be saying, I'm getting in the car, I'm on my way to Jet Park. We're just okay, are you okay? Are you okay? Wait till you settle down in the room at Jet Park and then we'll talk.
Ms. Taulealea Usumai says many were worried about who'd look after elderly relatives, pets or the household bills, something her team was able to help with, as well as directly helping those in the Jet Park. The family say they were well looked after by both the Whānau and health authorities. They say they were glad to have each other in quarantine, even if it was at a distance.
One thing that was really, really hard for our family is because we are a big family and we do everything collectively, we were all split up. And there was a time where I think all of us, we hadn't been together as a whole family within a month. It took us a whole month to finally get back together under one roof, to have share a meal together, spend quality time together as a family.
The women say the children coped well, but it was sad to see they were a bit ashamed or afraid to tell anyone that had the virus. They say no one should feel that way, but everyone should take care because COVID's still a very real threat. Mō te hōtaka o te ata, ko Rowan Quinn tēnei.
An archaeology project to find and exhume unmarked graves at a central Otago cemetery begins today. The delicate University of Otago task at the 150-year-old Dry Bread Cemetery near Omako will take about a month. The cemetery was established in the early 1860s during a gold rush, but faded away about 30 years later as the diggers moved on. We're joined by the project's co-leader, Professor Hayley Buckley. Good morning.
Kia ora.
Now, so why is this being done?
The main reason for the project is to assist the trust members, the trust leaders there, who are in charge of managing the cemetery, to try and assist them with identifying the unmarked graves in the cemetery. At present, it's still an active cemetery, and so they're wanting to know where these gaps are and where there's no headstones, if they can actually still use that ground. So that's sort of the primary aim. And then the secondary aim is for us to try and learn more about the early lives of these people who were living and working on the goldfields.
And what do we know? I mean, what are you thinking that you will find in terms of the people that were there?
Well, from our previous work in areas in Milton and Lawrence, we've found that these old cemeteries, they don't tend to sort of play by the rules in terms of what people understand with the current boundaries and so forth. So often we find graves outside of the current boundaries that are known, fenced areas. And and from our research, we've been finding a lot of very interesting information about their diet, their health. There's quite high levels of trauma amongst these people. It's a very dangerous existence working on these gold fields. So people experienced quite nasty accidents. And our work is also looking at chemical analysis of diet. So we're able to actually look at the different tissues, their teeth, which tell us about their childhood, and then also the bone tissue, which tells us about the last few years of their life, which was after they had moved here to New Zealand. And so we're able to see what their experiences were as children back at home, because these are mostly first-generation European and Chinese people, and then look at the changes in their diet and health when they actually arrived.
So I was going to ask you, will a number of them be Chinese migrants who are working on the goldfields?
Yeah, we've certainly found this in the Lawrence Cemetery. The story is at Dry Bread is that there were four Chinese people interred at Dry Bread, and that they had been exhumed and sent back home under one of the two exhumation and repatriation projects that the Chinese did, the infamous Ventnor being one. The story is that they were exhumed. However, what we are finding with these old cemeteries is that usually the stories don't necessarily hold true. So basically, we'll be exploring the areas in the cemetery where there are no headstones to see where people are buried. If there are people buried there, and we may find more Chinese than what the local legend says.
I mean, obviously this is a pretty sensitive issue, isn't it? So how do you go about that? Do you have a ceremony before you start? What's the process?
Yes, so today in the afternoon there will be blessings from opening blessings from the different church denominations, and also we have very excellent and ongoing support from the Chinese community. So we will have Leslie and Maisie Wong helping with a blessing and honouring of the ancestors, of the Chinese ancestors, before we begin.
And the work itself must be, well, pretty full on as well, I imagine, for those doing the analysis.
Yeah, I mean, physically it's hard work, and all of us in the team are very mindful of the sensitivity and the honour, really, of what it is that we're doing. So we're all professionals, and we're all, used to working in these kinds of conditions. So basically, as we work very, very carefully and methodically, and to honour the people and ensure that while we're doing the work, that we're gathering as much information as we possibly can to make the work worthwhile. And then, of course, with this project and with previous projects, the people will be reinterred. So we perform the exhumations and take care of the people back in our lab and perform our analyses, and then they're returned back to the graveyard.
Hey, that's fantastic. Thank you very much for talking to us about that. That is Professor Hayley Buckley there.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.